Today's Access Utah episode was first broadcast in April 2019.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In 1893, a deputy sheriff knocked on Matilda Jocelyn Gage's door in Fayetteville, New York. He had come to arrest her. "All the crimes which I was not guilty of rushed through my mind," she wrote later, "but I failed to remember that I was a born criminal, a woman. Her crime, registering to vote. The verdict, guilty as charged." And this is from a book, Born Criminal. Matilda Jocelyn Gage, radical suffragist. The author is Angelica Shirley Carpenter. She goes on to write here that Matilda was actually pleased to be arrested. She welcomed attention to her cause, women's rights. She was a famous leader in the early women's movement, a writer, organizer, speaker, planner, and historian. She worked closely with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but today she's mostly forgotten after those so-called friends wrote her out of history. And Angelica Shirley Carpenter writes, "I hope my book will help write her back in." We have Angelica Shirley Carpenter with us for the hour. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
Should mention a bit of your biography. Angelica Shirley Carpenter has a master's degree in education and library science from University of Illinois. For 16 years, served as director of the Palm Springs, Florida Public Library, where she founded Bookfest of Palm Beaches, an annual literary festival. In 2011, she retired from the Arne Nixon Center for Study of Children's Literature at California State University, Fresno. Currently resides in Fresno, is active in the International Wizard of Oz Club, the Lewis Carroll Society of North America, and the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. So, a lot going on. Appreciate you taking some of that time for us.
Oh, thank you. It's fun.
Should mention, we'll get into this as we go along. Not only is Matilda Jocelyn Gage a fascinating figure in American history, in women's rights, she's the mother-in-law of L. Frank Baum.
Yeah, and that's how I found her.
Okay.
I was always an Oz fan, a childhood Oz fan. I loved L. Frank Baum. And in the 90s, my mother and I wrote a middle grade biography of L. Frank Baum, who wrote the Oz books. And that's kind of what put Matilda on my radar.
Yeah. You know, kind of a Forrest Gump deal here. It's she was everywhere.
She was.
maybe we could start with this question. You treat this well known at the time. Right? It was kind of a triumvirate. Susan B. Anthony, mm-hmm. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Matilda Jocelyn Gage was right up there. Why don't we know about her today?
Well, she, first of all, she didn't seek personal glory, certainly not as much as Anthony did. She didn't write an autobiography. Her children didn't write books about her, and these things happened about Stanton, wrote an autobiography. Your kids wrote about her. But I think the real reason is she and Susan B. Anthony always had a kind of a rival relationship. Even though they were friends and colleagues and worked together, they were also rivals, especially in Susan B. Anthony's mind. And they just kind of clashed over several different issues. Matilda was generally more radical than Anthony. And Anthony wanted to be the star of the women's movement. And so after Matilda died before Anthony did and before Elizabeth Cady Stanton did, and they went on writing and working after she died, and they just wrote history with her left out. Mm-hmm. But they did it to her while she was alive, too. For instance, all three of them worked together on this book called A History of Women's Suffrage. And even while, I mean, one time when they were at a convention, she was sitting right there in a chair, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony talked about the book as if they had written it and didn't even mention her name. Mm-hmm. Also, if they would do newspaper interviews, they would talk as if she were not involved in the book. And Susan B. Anthony sometimes stole Matilda's writing, signed her own name to it. She really wasn't the writer. And Matilda felt like that deprived her of not just fame, but her income, because her income was from lecturing and, you know, she had to have her name out there. So Susan B. Anthony also, Matilda thought Susan B. Anthony cheated her out of money on the book deal. So there were a lot of reasons. They never stopped working together. Matilda always admired Susan B. Anthony and said, you know, it's a shame she just can't be satisfied with the good deeds she's done, because she's done wonderful things. I don't know why she has to take mine. So really, I don't know that they plotted together to write Matilda out of history, but they did. They wrote history. I mean, the history is written by the people who survive and the winners who write about it, and they just wrote history without Matilda.
Mm. What do you think we miss when Matilda Jocelyn Gage is written out of the women's movement?
Well, you miss a lot of who really was the backbone of organizing it. Anthony and Stanton were both stars on the lecture circuit, as Matilda was too, but to a lesser degree. She was the one who organized the conferences, who, she established a structure for the New York State Woman Suffrage Association. She started it up. She told the women how to begin to compile lists in their counties, alphabetical order. And she said, now don't pick people with big names, pick people who will do work. And she developed this state structure, and she was convinced it would work, and it did. And then she went down to Virginia and implemented the same state structure there. So she did a lot of the backbone work of the National Woman Suffrage Association. And she was president for a year, and she was just always chairman of the, the organizing committee. Mm-hmm. She was like the planner. She was a real expert in civil disobedience, which was one of their tactics. And so, like, for instance, she filed a bill. She had her representative file a bill in Congress to restore her voting rights, which, of course, she'd never had.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't work, but women all over the country had their congressmen file bills to restore their voting rights. And it got a lot of publicity for the cause.
Mm-hmm.
So she just had a lot of strategy and hard work. And she was a wonderful writer, too.
Yeah. The title, Born Criminal, that's included in that anecdote at the beginning of the book, right? The deputy sheriff comes to arrest her, and the crime is that she had attempted to vote.
Right.
So I think we forget. We're coming up on the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, right? We forget what the state of women was.
And they had absolutely no rights. To her, they were political slaves. Women were in the control of their fathers until they married. It was expected that they would marry. They couldn't vote. They couldn't serve on juries. They couldn't own property. Married women couldn't sign contracts. Whenever Matilda would have a contract to sign, like renting a hall or renting a rooms, Susan B. Anthony would have to come from wherever she was and sign the contract, because only single women could sign contracts. They had no rights to their children. That was one of the more shocking things. If a marriage ended, the man got the children. So they worked decades, and they did change some of these. They got the property laws changed in New York, at least, so that married women could own property. And, I mean, they had an impact even in their lifetimes, but they didn't see the vote.
What were the arguments against specifically women's suffrage?
They're so amazing. It's hard to even believe. Let me read you a little passage about the first conference she attended was in Syracuse in 1852. And at that time, voting was so controversial. They put it in two categories. They would talk about rights for women, and then they would talk about votes for women, because some people wouldn't support voting. Don't ask me why. They thought it would harm them physically, that it went against nature, that they'd be giving birth on the floor of the Senate, crazy things. This is from a newspaper after that 1852 conference. The Syracuse Daily Star said, "Perhaps we owe an apology for having given publicity to the mass of corruption, heresies, ridiculous nonsense, and reeking vulgarities which these bad women have vomited forth for the past 3 days." That was a pretty typical reaction. They thought the women were satanic, atheists, hermaphrodites. They called them everything. So one of the insults was strong-minded women. I kind of like that one, But it's almost beyond our ability to imagine what an uproar this caused and how they were attacked.
Yeah. I wonder if you could read another, I marked this, page 97.
Okay.
This is what Matilda Jocelyn Gage wrote. I think she's engaging in a little bit of hyperbole here.
I believe she is.
I hope, but still it illustrates The point that we're making here.
Right. What is to be done with women, Matilda asked. They will persist in being born. The old heathen fashion was to bury the unwelcome female infants alive, throw them to the crocodiles, or expose them to die of cold and starvation. I am not quite sure, but we had better return to these customs. It is quite certain they cannot all marry, and many who do marry are not only compelled to support themselves, but also a husband and children. We do not want to pay them good wages. We do not want them to govern themselves. In fact, we don't need them, so many of them in the world anyway. There has been a mistake made somewhere, and I am quite sure it is in woman's being born at all.
Yeah, that's she's, I don't know how over the top she was there. I mean, she's expressing a view which was rooted in the laws and the customs and the
right. And unlike Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and the other leaders of the movement, she always thought about working women. I mean, she always thought about the women who worked in factories and had nowhere to live that was safe. She thought about prostitutes. She felt that prostitution was an economic issue, that the women had no training, no education, and no chance to work in professions that paid well. So she, whereas many people in the movement saw it as immoral, and saw the prostitutes as wicked, Matilda always sympathized with them and always with working women.
Mm-hmm. So this was not the case in other parts of the movement?
No,
it's kind of a middle class movement.
Middle class. Anthony and Stanton were both educated, all of them. People say I'm ruining their impression of Susan B. Anthony, and I don't like to do that. But truly, Matilda was much more egalitarian than either of them. When they were campaigning for women's rights after the Civil War, there was a movement then to say that African American men should get the vote right then, and they did. Matilda thought everybody should get the vote, but Stanton and Anthony, in their bitterness about this movement for the African-American men, denigrated them, said bad things about them, and also, really said bad things about immigrants and uneducated people. Matilda thought everybody should have the vote.
Mm. Brings up an interesting point. We tend to, I guess once a movement is successful, then the iconography begins, right? Then we want to whitewash, airbrush out the blemishes of the founders of the movements.
It's, mm-hmm.
But it's probably healthy for us to realize Susan B. Anthony and, Matilda Joslyn Gage had a running disagreement. There were disagreements in the movement.
Yes, I think that's true.
Bad things
in any
happened,
movement.
And yet it went on despite those things.
Exactly. And Susan B. Anthony came to visit Matilda on her deathbed, so as much as they'd fought, they still cared about each other.
Yeah. So I was surprised to learn through reading your book, there was an Equal Rights Amendment way back then.
Yeah. We still don't have it.
We still don't have it. That's right. Yeah. So looking for the vote, but also, just complete
equal rights.
Equal pay
for equal work. Matilda spoke out often in support of a woman's right to control her own body, for instance, not to be raped by her husband. Anybody who was talking about birth control in public in those days or mailing information got arrested. And there was birth control, that there were ways to prevent people from getting pregnant, but it was illegal to talk about it or mail information about it. So she always spoke very frankly about these issues, which may have been one of her issues with Susan B. Anthony. It's not that Anthony didn't believe those things. It's just she thought it kind of detracted from suffrage. She thought suffrage. And Matilda and Stanton, too, both thought suffrage was the means to equality in many, many areas.
Mm-hmm. There was a disagreement apparently about religion.
Yes, and same thing. Matilda felt that religion had oppressed women for centuries. And she was a very good historian. She wrote a wonderful book called Woman, Church, and State, which began with church-controlled societies oppressing women, and then as the societies became more secular, the laws took on the same oppression of women. And she really, I mean, she took it right up to the present time. When she wrote that book, which was in 1893, she wrote about the legal age of consent for sexual activity. In Connecticut at that time, it was 7 years old. So this was a shocking, it is today that's shocking. Susan B. Anthony just didn't want that kind of shocking news associated with suffrage. But Matilda got, this was one of her great coups. She donated a copy of her book to, I think, Fayetteville High School, where she lived in New York. And a school board member sent it to Anthony Comstock, who was the head of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. And he threatened on the front pages of newspapers to arrest anybody who gave it to a child. So he wasn't worried about the 7-year-olds getting raped. He was worried about that people might read about it, you know? Yeah, Matilda loved it that Anthony Comstock condemned her book. She was hoping that the Pope would condemn it too, but I guess he didn't know about it.
Yeah. So, the women at the head of the movement, also, you know, others, you know, toiling in the trenches, did know the value of this kind of publicity.
Oh, yes. Right? They counted on it. And Matilda, you know, they had demonstrations, they had petitions. They got petitions with hundreds of thousands of names on them and delivered them to Congress constantly.
Yeah.
Year after year, they marched them in and, you know, they had meetings and they introduced bills and they just never stopped. They did it on all fronts.
Yeah. I was interested to learn about the celebration for the Statue of Liberty.
Oh yeah!
Tell me about that. What was?
Well, that was one of my favorite things I learned about doing the research for this. Matilda and her friend Lily Devereux Blake, who was also active in the National, were very active in the National. I mean, in the New York State Women's Suffrage Association. So when they found out that the Statue of Liberty was going to be a woman, they thought that was pretty funny because women had no liberty in the United States. And they applied to speak at the dedication to make a point that women should have liberty. And they were, of course, turned down. But there was going to be a boat parade out to the statue. And they did get permission to, if they could get a boat, be in the boat parade. Well, the only boat they could find was a cattle barge. It was a 2-story cattle barge and rented for $100 a day. And they raised the money, and the captain promised them that he would clean the barge before they got on it. He would scour the boat, but he didn't. So when the day dawned and the women gathered on the pier in New York to get on the boat, some of them were overcome by the stench, and they refused to board. But Matilda, she had a cow at home, so I guess she wasn't too upset, and she and 200 other people got on the boat. They sailed out to the statue. They anchored this little cattle barge between two big warships right at the foot of the statue. Just by accident, they got a good place. And they yelled through megaphones. And the really fun thing for me is I have a picture book coming out about this in 2020. I mean, I just could not get these images out of my mind. And I love that story.
How is the work done? You get pieces in the newspaper, I imagine. You write books. You go on speaking tours. How is the work done?
Yeah, you just nailed it all there. And conventions.
Mm-hmm.
Newspapers were so different in those days. You know, that was social media in those days, and there were so many newspapers. Even little towns had 2 or 3 newspapers, and they were quite. The articles were quite lengthy and detailed. Matilda grew up near Syracuse and was always around the Haudenosaunee Indians. And the newspapers covered both the European culture and the Indian culture. So she knew a lot about them. She knew a lot about their theory of democracy, in which women had many more rights. The Indian women had many more rights than the women in the United States. So that's just an aside, but she wrote for newspapers from San Francisco to New York. She wrote when in Fayetteville, the little town where she lived near Syracuse, they had a bunch of arrests for prostitution. And, of course, none of the men involved got arrested, and they were all prominent people in the town. And she wrote to them and protested and just constantly writing. And not just her, but, you know, all over the country women were doing this.
And I'm guessing that progress was slow.
Yeah.
but you know, you do gain adherence to the cause, mostly women. Were there men that supported the cause?
There were men, too. At first, they were ridiculed and reviled, okay? It was just insult after insult. But as time went on, they began to get a more serious hearing. And I don't have the passage marked, but one newspaper said after a convention, you know, someday somebody is going to take this seriously. And eventually they did. They had a very hard time getting in to testify before Congress and special committees, but they did eventually get to testify. And I know Senator Sumner was so impressed with their testimony and their seriousness and, you know, everything they did built on everything else, and they just sort of made respect for themselves.
What do you think was the tipping point or tipping points? Eventually, critical mass, right? A very close vote. You know, it came down to Tennessee to for
yeah,
the Constitutional
right.
Amendment. But
right.
What?
Well, I think by that
success,
time, by the 20th century, everybody knew it was going to happen. And they just didn't know when. And I think Woodrow Wilson did not want it to happen on his watch, but he had to give in because the movement had just taken on. And I think his daughter was influential in influencing that, too. I think, you know, I don't know, Grover Cleveland, he was just awful. When he left office, he wrote articles about how bad, what a bad influence women's clubs were. And it took women out of the home and took them away from their responsibilities, and they should just not be doing that. So it didn't happen on Grover Cleveland's watch, mm-hmm. but everybody knew that sooner or later women would get the vote.
Mm-hmm. I guess the truth so self-evident, that kind of thing.
What mm-hmm.
That's why it reached critical mass?
Yeah.
Yeah. We are, if you just joined us, we're talking with Angelica Shirley Carpenter. She is author of an interesting book, Born Criminal is the title, subtitled Matilda Jocelyn Gage, Radical Suffragist. She was right there at the forefront of the women's movement, the battle for suffrage, women's suffrage, but died earlier than her compatriots and was essentially written out of history. And Angelica Shirley Carpenter, one of her purposes here is to bring her back. So that's
right.
What we're doing. By the way, before we go to a break, suffragist, the appropriate term, not suffragette.
True. Suffragette was considered demeaning by the suffragists that I wrote about. But I didn't even know that till I started writing the book.
And today it's kind of we kind of go back and forth. Right. But suffragette was a bad term back then.
Yes.
What were you going to say?
Forgot.
Okay. All right. We'll recover that
okay.
possibly in our next segment. When we come back, I want to get into some of Matilda Jocelyn Gage's life. Interesting life.
Very.
Including her parents' home was a stop on the Underground Railroad.
It was. Hers,
And hers, too.
Yeah.
All right. Interesting. And don't forget, we'll get talking about Wizard of Oz. Matilda Jocelyn Gage, if she's not interesting enough, she's L. Frank Baum's mother-in-law.
Right.
And encouraged him to write his Wizard of Oz series. Much more following this break.
Hi, this is Nick Forster. This week in E-Town, we're going to revisit one of our favorite shows featuring two Donovans, Donovan Frankenreiter and Donovan Woods, great singer-songwriters, plus a conversation with Zara Alexandra about young people farming and ranching. That's all coming this week in E-Town.
Tune in Saturday evening at 7 here on UPR.
I'm John Florence, and I've got a program here on Utah Public Radio called The Music Never Stopped. It airs Sunday at 4 o'clock. With the Grateful Dead as our jumping-off point, we celebrate the music made in the moment. Because this song ain't never gonna end.
Today's Access Utah episode was first broadcast in April 2019.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We've reached our second segment here with Angelica Shirley Carpenter. We're talking about an interesting figure, a prominent figure in the women's rights movement from the 19th century, Matilda Jocelyn Gage. And Angelica Shirley Carpenter has written a book called Born Criminal. And you say, just to reiterate, Angelica Shirley Carpenter, Matilda Jocelyn Gage would have been well-known at the time.
Oh, she was very well-known at the time.
But She died earlier than Susan B. Anthony, for example, and the histories that came out didn't include Matilda Justin Gage.
It's true. I think many times with movements like that, there's one person who's identified, you know, Martin Luther King for civil rights or Cesar Chavez for the workers' movement in California. But I think more and more now people are looking at other people who are involved in the movement. And the New York Times recently had a big article about African-American women suffragists who had been involved at the time when Matilda was. She knew Sojourner Truth and respected her very much. But, you know, I don't know a lot else about what she knew about. I know there were African-Americans involved in some of the conferences she put on.
Yeah.
But so they're looking in, many people are looking into different aspects of the movement, different movements.
Yeah.
Too.
And Matilda Justin Gage is so interesting, so I'm glad you're bringing this history to us. The book is Born Criminal. That refers to the fact that, as she said, Matilda Justin Gage, I was born criminal, I was born a woman, and I can't vote, right?
She got arrested for registering to vote.
Yeah. So kind of, precursors to the civil rights movement there. So.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And she was very interested in civil rights. She was not interested just in women's rights. She wanted civil rights for everybody.
Yeah. So before we get into some of her fascinating history, you want to hear about Matilda Justin Gage, the person, and her family, including the westward urge, what Western fever they called
right?
Which her children caught. And that took her west. I want to talk about connections to Utah. So on the one hand, she felt that organized religion oppressed women.
Yes.
But she apparently supported.
She felt the women were not to blame for this.
Yeah. And she supported Mormon women, I guess.
She did indeed. In 1869, the women's movement split into two movements. The National Woman Suffrage Association, that was Matilda and her friends, were much more radical. And they supported Mormon women. They didn't approve of polygamy necessarily, but they supported Mormon women. And when they got the vote, they celebrated. And when they lost the vote, they celebrated. And the American Woman Suffrage Association condemned Mormon women and, you know, thought they were immoral in a way. So the Mormon women always looked to the national for help and for leadership. And the national had an International Council of Women meeting, I think, in 1888. And at least three Mormon women came to that as representatives of a particular movement. So Matilda always respected the women that were involved, no matter what, whether they were Chinese women or she called them Mohammedan women or, whatever, the women she supported.
And as you say, there was a split. Some of the prominent women did not support the Mormon women, I guess, because of polygamy?
Right, and they did not support the movement that women should get the vote right then. In 1869, they thought women could wait while African-American men got the vote. So they were ready to go much slower and, at a more conservative way of operating.
Now, women did get the vote earlier in the West.
Yeah, they did.
In Utah, in Wyoming. How was that seen? Was that seen as, I can imagine if you're in support of women's suffrage, you could say, see, the world hasn't collapsed.
Exactly. Well, they celebrated.
Because of this, yeah.
Some official from Wyoming went on that boat ride with them to the Statue of Liberty, and they celebrated him. I forget what his position was, but like vice governor or something. And then they celebrated. Susan B. Anthony came to Utah and celebrated with the women here who had the vote. I mean, yes, they thought it was great that these women had the vote.
What about the, anti-suffragists?
Well, they didn't like it. So funny. There are photographs of the anti-suffrage society store or sign, it's like a storefront with a big sign on it. Who could be anti-suffrage?
Yeah. And women anti-suffragists, right?
Yes, yes. They thought they were doing just fine. Men took care of them. They didn't need anything from beyond that. It's shocking, really.
Yeah. And as we mentioned earlier, the Equal Rights Amendment was proposed way back then.
Yeah, I think in 1870 or so.
Yeah. I want to talk about Matilda Justin Gage, the person. So maybe raised in New York?
Yeah, near Syracuse. Always
near Syracuse. Yeah. Her parents' home was a stop on the Underground Railroad?
Yeah, and that part of New York was a really hotbed of kind of religious and political activity. They were always looking for new ideas and new reforms. So her father was in on that all the way. He was for temperance. He was for rights for everybody, women and children, which was very unusual. And he was an abolitionist. So she grew up in that atmosphere. She started taking anti-slavery petitions around when she was 11 years old. So she always was, you know, and it was her father who taught her that when people criticized what abolitionists, for instance, until I read this book, I didn't realize how many people in the North hated abolitionists, you know, supported slavery. And they did things like drag William Lloyd Garrison through the streets of Boston and threaten to hang him. And this scared Matilda that somebody would do this to her father. And he said, oh, don't be scared. This just shows that we're doing something right. And that was her whole attitude all through her life. When she met with opposition, which she did pretty much at every step, that just confirmed to her that she was doing it right.
Hmm. So when the deputy sheriff shows up at her door...
Oh, she was thrilled.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess this kind of a home atmosphere where, you know, we're crusaders. What point did she take up the women's cause?
Probably as a teenager when she realized, well, she wanted to be a doctor like her father, and she helped him. She was really a medical assistant when she was a teenager, helped him with surgeries, and really wanted to be a doctor. And, of course, she couldn't get into medical school. But even before that, I think she had begun to realize how limited. She couldn't go to college, not just medical school. There were no colleges. She knew that her life would be limited as a woman. And by that time, she was well ingrained in the abolitionist movement. She knew that the techniques, which were meetings, newspaper articles, books, like you said earlier. And she knew that what worked in – there wasn't a women's movement when she was younger. She knew that what worked in one movement would work in another. And, in fact, all three of these movements, abolition, temperance, and the women's movement – work together sometimes, and they would have meetings that overlapped so that people could go to these horrible, dreaded liberal meetings that wanted to ruin society.
Right, right.
The same people would attend all three kinds of meetings.
Yeah, yeah. Well, these were, you know, pretty radical or considered radical ideas, but I'm sure that you see pictures that they show up and they look prim and proper, right?
Oh, they look great. They were very elegantly dressed, especially Matilda was conservative. She never wore bloomers like a lot of them did, but Matilda never did. But like, for instance, they staged a demonstration on the 4th of July in 1876. It was the nation's centennial. There was a big ceremony in Philadelphia at Independence Hall. Of course, they asked for permission to speak up on behalf of women and got told no. So they decided they'd write a Declaration of Independence for women and present it anyway. And, and President Grant was supposed to be there. He didn't actually show up, but he was supposed to be there. So they were going to give this to President Grant, whether he wanted it or not. And, you know, even in those days, there's a lot of security for a president of the United States. But when they went there, it was the vice president who was there. Mm. They came from behind. There was a grandstand behind the podium. They just zoomed up to the podium and gave this petition to the vice president. And the people who could have stopped them from doing that were soldiers and ushers, saw these nice-looking middle-class women, nicely dressed, and just backed off and let them do it. So they just stormed the podium, gave their petition to the vice president. He actually supported women's rights. He kept it, and he got it framed, and he hung it in his office.
Interesting. Yeah.
And then the ladies ran out the back throwing out copies of their declaration as they went. Nobody stopped them. But they were ready to be arrested that day. They really thought they might be.
Yeah. But, you know, some usefulness to middle-class respectability.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, yeah. Use that for the cause. As a teenager, I guess, she decided, well, I'm going to enlist myself in this cause. Did that color who she married, how her home life was, or was that pretty conventional, or what?
Well, it was pretty conventional. Her husband was also a political liberal, and she was only 18 when she got married. She had her first child at 19. So her husband was very supportive. He was a storekeeper, but he supported her in with money when she was traveling at first. And even though she probably always had help at home, she had four children and she couldn't have done all that traveling without his support. We have letters from him where he writes very proudly that she's in Washington and he's taking their youngest daughter on a picnic. And, you know, he was an unusual, I think. Well, I don't know. He wouldn't be so unusual now, but maybe in that time he was unusual.
Would have been unusual at the time, and the husband support the wife and her work and the cause, or I guess it all stripes of situations.
Yes, Stanton's husband wasn't too happy when she got into it, but I think he came around eventually.
So at a certain point, the kids grow up. By the way, they did send at least some of their kids to college, right?
They sent all of them.
All the kids to college. Yeah.
And she had fought so hard to get the girls to go to college. Her oldest daughter became a school principal. Her middle daughter became a teacher. Her son graduated from Cornell, became a storekeeper like his father. And her youngest daughter, Maud, went to Cornell for 2 years until she dropped out of college almost over Matilda's dead body to get married.
Yeah. To L. Frank Baum.
We'll to get L. Frank there. Baum.
So if you just joined us, we're talking about a book, Born Criminal, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, Radical Suffragist. The author is Angelica Shirley Carpenter. So before we go to another break, I want to talk about the westward trip this family took. I guess the kids first, some of the kids.
Yes.
Decided to go out to, they got Western fever, as they called it, went out to Dakota Territory.
And one of the reasons for Western fever was that things weren't going so well with the economy in central New York. It was just a hard time there. And business was booming in Dakota, and railroads had just reached Aberdeen. And, Western fever was a thing. And Aberdeen had a lot of people from Syracuse living in it. So one by one, her adult children all moved to Dakota. One of them lived on a homestead north of Aberdeen, but the other three lived in Aberdeen. And it was quite a thriving town. It had the first electric lights and telephones maybe outside of New York. You know, it was quite a modern, up-to-date town, and she really liked it. She spent her winters there with her youngest daughter, Maud, and Maud's husband, L. Frank Baum. Mm.
And continued her work there.
Oh, yeah.
When she was there.
Always.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In fact, she went out, when just two of her kids lived there, she went out and campaigned for women's rights as South Dakota began its campaign to enter as a state, you know, to move from a territory to a state. You know, she didn't win, but she went around the state and campaigned and made speeches and wrote letters to the women of South Dakota and to the men of South Dakota, do the right thing, you know.
Yeah. At a certain point, her husband's a
storekeeper.
Shopkeeper.
Yeah.
The store does well for a while, right?
Yes,
that's how they put
well.
The kids through college.
Right.
At a certain point, it begins to fail.
Yes, and that's at the same time, the store started to fail. His health started to fail. She was always worried about money toward the end of her life. And even after they went to Dakota, they all struggled. The son seems to have done all right. He had a couple of stores in Dakota, but the rest of them really struggled to make a living. You know, they had a terrible drought in Dakota in around 1890, so the businesses there weren't doing well either.
Mm-hmm. So the same vicissitudes in life that many would
right.
encounter. On top of that, she's doing her other work, right?
The yeah.
women's suffrage work. Let's take another break. When we come back, I want to get to this connection with Wizard of Oz. Very, very, very interesting. You couldn't make this stuff up, right? If you were to write a novel, you'd
well,
say...
Well, there is a novel now.
Oh, is there a novel?
It's called Finding Dorothy.
Oh, okay, great. But, you know, if it was totally fictional, you'd say, oh, okay, that's going too far, right?
I think so.
Some of these things, but this is actual history. So let's talk more about Matilda Jocelyn Gage. The book is Born Criminal. The author is Angelica Shirley Carpenter. More following this.
Now that Zorba Pastor On Your Health has ended, we're bringing an encore broadcast of BBC's The Arts Hour to Sunday afternoons at 1.
Hello and welcome to The Arts Hour on the BBC World Service. I'm Nikki Beatty, bringing you a star-studded lineup of global guests, some cultural companionship, and the very best arts and culture conversation from across the BBC and beyond.
You can catch The Arts Hour Friday afternoons at 1, and now Sunday afternoons at 1 as well, part of our new Sunday lineup here on Utah Public Radio.
Sponsoring Utah Public Radio programming is a great way to share information about your company with our statewide audience and can attract qualified employees and help you share information about milestones you have achieved. For information on how you can become a UPR program sponsor, go to upr.org/sponsor.
Today's Access Utah episode was first broadcast in April 2019.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We've reached our last segment with Angelica Shirley Carpenter. We're talking about her book, Born Criminal, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, Radical Suffragist. About 10 minutes left. Want to now turn to the connection to Wizard of Oz. This is so fascinating. She's, you know, prominent leader in the women's suffrage movement. Not as well known now for the reasons we've talked about, but hopefully restore her in that way. But also, she's
the mother-in-law of L. Frank Baum.
So her youngest daughter, Maude,
meets this fellow.
Tell us a little bit about L. Frank Baum.
Well, when Maude, the daughter, met him, he was about 25. He hadn't had much schooling. He was from a wealthy family. He'd mostly been educated at home, but not very much. And he was working as a playwright, producer, and star of a musical. And Maude was in her second year at Cornell. And boy, Matilda did not think he looked like a good bet for a husband. You know, it didn't look like he was going to be able to support her. She really respected education, and he didn't have any. So she was very much opposed to the wedding, but her daughter was just like her and said, well, I'm going to marry him anyway. Mm. So they had the wedding at home, and Frank was so charming and so nice, and he really worked to win Matilda over. I mean, at the time he married her daughter, he was a nobody, and Matilda was a nationally known celebrity. So, but he really, she came to love him. You know, he just loved her, too. And later on in life, well, he had many jobs before he got around to writing children's books in his 40s. And he used to always tell stories to his four sons. And she loved his stories. And she encouraged him to write the stories down and to try to get them published. So it's fun to think of them. Eventually, the Baums moved to Chicago. And again, Matilda spent a lot of time with them, lived with them in Chicago. It's fun to think of them writing under the same roof. And he's writing fairy tales. And she's writing these really radical feminist diatribes, okay? And anyway, she was there for the publication of his first book, which was called, children's book, which was called Mother Goose in Prose. And it was based on stories he had told his sons, like, why did the mouse run up the clock? And how could 24 blackbirds be baked in a pie? So she celebrated the publication of that book. She died in 1898, and The Wonderful Wizard of Oz didn't come out till 1900. So she wasn't physically there anymore, but I think she's there in the Oz books because, you know, look at, in the first book, of course, Dorothy is this strong, brave, American, practical heroine, you know. She melts the witch, she grabs up a broom and sweeps her out the door. I mean, she just, like Matilda, she was doing housework and, you know, fighting for her ideas. And at the end of that book, the wizard flies off in his balloon, and in the second, a lot of people don't know there are 14 Oz books by L. Frank Baum, but in the second one, The Marvelous Land of Oz, a fairy princess comes to the throne, and after that, for the next 12 books, Oz is a feminist utopia ruled by women, and so I definitely think Matilda is there. One way and another. L. Frank Baum pokes a little bit of fun at her in the second Oz book. He has a character called Ginger, and he has General Ginger and her army of revolt, and they're trying to take over the Emerald City. and when they knock on the door, the gatekeeper says, you know, what do you want? And General Ginger says, we're revolting. They're very pretty, all of them. They're wearing uniforms. And he says, well, you don't look revolting. So Baum had a little fun teasing the feminists, but he really believed in it. He actually kept some of her work in print, you know, had it reissued and republished and stayed on it. So he really came to admire her.
Mm. So the influence is there. You think, and you'd be inescapable. He admired her.
Oh, yeah.
Immensely. Lived in the same house with her during periods. I guess through her daughter, Maud. Maud would have similar characteristics to her mother.
She did indeed.
So L. Frank Baum, how did he start out? He was a storekeeper as well, was he?
At first he was in the theater. Then his play went bankrupt, and he came home and sold Baum's Castorine, which was an axle lubricant, whatever that is, a family business. Then he moved out to Dakota, where he had a store. When that failed, he bought a newspaper. When that failed, he moved to Chicago. Then he began to become became a salesman for a China company, and he actually did quite well at that. But it meant he had to be away from home during the week because he was always out on the road selling china, and it meant he had to lift big, heavy boxes of china. And that's when he did his writing for his sons. When he was on the road, he would write little verses and stories and poems. Mm. And then when he came home, he would read them to the boys or tell them to the boys. So finally, you know, in his late 40s, and with Matilda telling him, write it down, he submitted it to a publisher there in Chicago and began to get published. Mm-hmm. And after that, he was fine. He made a good living. Well, he didn't manage money very well, but his wife, Maud, figured that out and took over the family funds.
Okay, very good. Right. Very good. And then they did well from there.
Yeah.
So this started with stories for his boys.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So there were, he didn't, as you said, he didn't start out immediately with the Wizard of Oz series.
No, I think he had always told stories to his kids, but you know, according to him, he was in Chicago one day, and I would assume this is after Matilda had died, but he said he was going out one day, and the kids came in at the same time and said, tell us a story, and he just started telling a story about a little girl named Dorothy. You know, and the big legend is that he needed a name for the land, and he looked over at his file cabinet, and the bottom drawer was labeled O to Z, so he named it Oz. Mm. Now, that's probably not even true, but everybody tells that story. I mean, his wife said that wasn't true, but he used to tell that story to newspapers all the time.
That's how it happens, isn't it?
You know, yeah.
Maybe a story starts somewhere, and the author himself picks it up.
Oh, he loved to play tricks on people and talk about things in newspapers that weren't necessarily true.
Yeah. Oh, did he?
Yeah.
a mischievous streak.
Yes, exactly.
So Oz, this world, has had such a tremendous effect. It's been so popular, and then of course the movie and so, you know.
We've got Wicked now, and you know, it's going to be a movie too, and we had the Great and Powerful Oz, and there's just no end to it. But which is good by my standards.
I'm
the past president of the International Wizard of
Oz
Club.
Yes, yes. So what do you think that influence is? What do you how has it influenced boys and girls and men and women?
Well, boys and girls still love Oz. The Oz characters are like the characters from Alice in Wonderland for Lewis Carroll. I mean, Oz characters represent America around the world. When people see the Scarecrow and the Tinwoodman, they think America. So it's just ingrained. You know, we all know lines from the movie. I've got a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. But, you know, there wouldn't have been a movie without the book.
yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And it's just wonderful. And each new incarnation, well, some of the incarnations are a little raunchy for me, but because I like my Oz sunny side up. Mm-hmm. But each new thing that comes along just, engages children and young people in new ways. I think Harry Potter even led people back to Oz. You know, it made fantasy acceptable in a way it hadn't been for a long time. And I don't know if that, I mean, because Harry Potter's for an older audience of readers, but I think Oz just goes on. It really does.
So L. Frank Baum died in May of 1914, was it? 1919. So he would have lived through the Great War.
Yes,
I guess,
did.
And died just after that. This is some 20 years after Matilda Jocelyn Gage. Did he live to see the influence of the books?
Oh, yeah.
The explosion, sure. Okay, of popularity.
For sure. And his wife, Maud, lived to see the making of the MGM movie.
Oh, she did?
Uh-huh. She attended the premiere. And that's what this new novel called Finding Dorothy by Elizabeth Letts is about. It's about Maud and the making of the MGM movie, but also about Maud's life from childhood forward. And Matilda's a character in that book. Now, that book is, I would say, heavily fictionalized. But still, it gives you a feel for the atmosphere of the time. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess bringing it back to Matilda Joslyn Gage, what do you think she would have thought of Wizard of Oz and the popularity of the series?
So proud of it. And I think she would have thought, well, boy, I taught that man right. So I think she would have really liked it.
Do you think those influences that you see in the books, do you think that has an effect? The fact that this was, kingdom after the second book was ruled by a princess and those sorts of things?
I think definitely it did for me. Yeah, I do. I think, there's been this theory that boys will only read about boys, but I think plenty of boys read Oz books, and boys will read an exciting story about, a hero or a heroine who's brave and does things. So, yeah, I think definitely.
Yeah, I certainly did. Loved the Oz books, yes, as a young man. So just at the end of the conversation here, what's the biggest takeaway about Matilda Joslyn Gage that you want people to?
Well, I just came to admire her so much. So I think people should think about who's in their family that maybe was involved in the women's movement that we don't know about. Maybe they can ask somebody. I mean, that's been very interesting to me. People, as I tell them about this book, they say, oh, well, my grandmother got arrested, or my great-grandmother got arrested at the White House for demonstrating. So, it's just interesting from that way of thinking. As for Matilda herself, she's really an inspiration to me. She worked till the day she died, never gave up. And this idea of if you're meeting criticism or opposition, you're doing something right. You never lose sight of your ideals and you never compromise. Anthony was willing to compromise, but Matilda never compromised. And opposition just made her stronger. I wish that would happen to me, but so far it hasn't.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, may it happen to all of us. Right?
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly.
A good example. Well, very interesting history. The book is Born Criminal, Matilda Joslyn Gage, Radical Suffragist. The author is Angelica Shirley Carpenter. Angelica Shirley Carpenter, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I'm glad you're an Oz fan.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. Love it. Love it. And thanks for listening to Access Utah.
This is Science by the Slice. Alpacas, which are part of the Camelidae family, including camels and llamas, have a unique class of antibodies called heavy chain-only antibodies, or HCABs. USU undergrad researcher James Cisneros, who is a human biology major, says HCABs are more stable than conventional antibodies, such as human antibodies, and smaller, which enables them to enter cells and cross the blood-brain barrier. With USU faculty mentor Zhang Dewang, Cisneros is hoping to work toward understanding how to genetically engineer alpaca antibodies using CRISPR technology to combat human diseases such as cancer, Alzheimer's disease, and viral infections.
This segment of Science by the Slice is brought to you by the USU College of Arts and Sciences, offering degree programs in the sciences and mathematics. Details at artsci.usu.edu.
Programming support here on Utah Public Radio comes from our members and the Quinney College of Agriculture and Applied Resources at USU. With a degree in soils and sustainable land systems, where students gain understanding of the physical, chemical, and biological processes that occur at the Earth's surface. Information at adbs.usu.edu. Support for UPR also comes from the Cash Chamber of Commerce, presenting the Cash Influence Women in Leadership Conference, including a jewelry sale supporting women in business scholarships, October 29th at the Riverwoods Conference Center. Details at cashchamber.com.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide listener-supported service of Utah State University and the College of Arts and Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan. Also heard at upr.org or on the UPR app.